Coming up on Tech Nation, Deva Sobel, whom you remember from her books Longitude and Galileo's Daughter. She's here today with The Glass Universe, how the ladies of the Harvard Observatory took the measure of the stars. Then on Biotech Nation, Health Prize Technologies create strategies to get patients to take their prescribed medications. It's even a problem to get them to fill out their initial prescriptions. And RespireRx, they're working on multiple approaches to circumvent the respiratory problems related to opioids. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
I drove over the hill the other day, which isn't all that remarkable since I live in San Francisco. But what I saw for the very first time in my view of downtown was a huge skyscraper, noticeably bigger and higher than anything nearby. Your brain does funny things when it sees something different from what it expects. And my reptilian brain, the oldest part of our human neurocapacity and in control of such vitals as heart rate and breathing, decided to bring me up short. I pulled over and got out my smartphone. I soon learned that I was looking at Salesforce Tower, about to be the tallest building in San Francisco, or actually already there, but not quite completed. It had no nearby buddies to compare to, as the formerly highest record holder, the famous Transamerica Pyramid, is some number of blocks away and happened to be out of my view. Even so, the pyramid narrows as it goes up, ultimately poking modestly into the sky. Not so with Salesforce Tower. It goes straight up, filling the entire airspace, wall to wall. We haven't seen such changes in San Francisco's skyline since the pyramid made its debut in 1972, nearly a half century ago. Now that's old news, dwarfed by this new tower, which stands solitary and embraced in construction cladding, multiple cranes forming an optical balancing act. There's a new skyline here, all right, and my conscious brain told whatever other parts of my brain that would listen, you had better get used to this, and fast. I've had this feeling before, also driving near my home, when I expected to look across the tops of the trees in Golden Gate Park. And then one day, pop! The new DeYoung Fine Arts Museum, rebuilt to address its earthquake problems, introduced a taller tower. Its observation deck enables a 360-degree view, but as they say, if they can see you, you can see them. This got me to thinking about all kinds of structures that have been built by humans over the centuries. There's the Great Wall of China, or rather a succession of walls, which given the technology couldn't have sprung up so fast it took anyone by surprise. Even the Eiffel Tower was built close in to some old Paris neighborhoods. Think about going outside, and the Eiffel Tower is, look up, right there. If the Parisians had only extended its antenna by 7 feet, it would match the height of Salesforce Tower. Yet, like the Transamerica Pyramid, the point of the Eiffel Tower pokes respectfully into the sky, transparent through its famous iron erector set struts. Building large structures, whether walls or towers or skyscrapers, has been a curious human endeavor for as long as humans have invented the technology to do so. Whether defensive or political or economic or just because we could, they were built. And somehow, history and photographs and everything internet tends to look at the structures and not the people. Not the many, many people whose personal space becomes changed forever. Medieval towns dwarfed by castles large and small, bridges across pristine waters, and much, much more. And then I remembered, Golden Gate Park is not the natural habitat of a dense stand of trees. No, it's sand dunes, all the way to the beach. Another example of grand vision and technology. Humans have an incredible ability to embrace technology as if it were a natural and permanent part of our lives. That in itself is very curious. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, Deva Sobel. You remember her from her books Longitude and Galileo's Daughter. She's back with the contribution of the women at the Harvard Observatory in the late 1800s. It moved the science of astronomy forward. Then on Biotech Nation, getting patients to take their prescribed medications and one company's approaches to improve the respiratory effects of opioids. First, scientists observe. Then they start measuring and classifying and grading, and then the real insights and understanding begins. Deva Sobel is the author of The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars.
These women had a unique resource in glass photographic plates, so it was the very beginning of the application of photography to astronomy, which was questioned by some people. Some people felt there was no substitute for the eye of an experienced observer and that these plates were questionable, but they were quickly proven wrong. The director of the observatory, Edward Pickering, wanted to make a complete record of the night sky, which meant he had to open an observatory in the southern hemisphere, as well as use the Harvard telescope in Cambridge. He had an enormous influx of money from an heiress who wanted to see this work done. And that money enabled him to go search out another spot in the southern hemisphere, hire more people, buy scads and scads of glass plates, which he used up at a great clip. There are 500,000 of them now, still at Harvard.
Now, explain for us glass plate photography in the sense that you've got your telescope. Usually we think these astronomers are looking through the telescope, making sort of hand recordings.
But yes, now, originally they would draw. They would make sketches of what they saw. But now they could, at the beginning, pretty much strap a camera on the telescope and have long exposures so that instead of waiting for a clear moment, the light from the stars would build up on the plates over a period of hours in some cases. So stars that had never been seen before would appear.
Now the glass is clear?
The glass has photographic emulsion on it, but the developed plate is definitely see-through, but you also see on it part of the universe.
Are those dark spots against the... How does that... Sometimes you see the reversal, you see...
Yes, there were several types of plates made. So there are starscapes where there are just many, many black dots on a white background, but some of the most interesting plates are the spectra. So there's a prism put over the light gathering end of the telescope, and all the starlight is split into a continuous strip. And because the photographs were black and white, the spectra don't look rainbow colored the way we usually think of them or see them. But they definitely have a pattern. And the challenge to the women was to look at these patterns and figure out a way to divide the stars into categories. And they managed to do it. And in fact, their system is still used today. At the beginning, it was completely empirical. Nobody knew
what
are we looking at? What does this mean? What, if the patterns are different, why are they different? Are there different chemicals involved, different temperatures, different stages in the life cycles of stars? What is it? Nobody knew. But within a few decades, everybody did know.
Enough data, you can see it. Now, are the plates like a 5x7 card, a little like a book size? What are we talking?
Like a window pane, like 8x10.
Big.
And some 11x17. The big telescope in South America, which was paid for by another heiress.
Heiresses and astronomy. Yes.
Yes. That's one of the most interesting things to me about this story. I got interested in it because there were so many women doing the work. But then it turned out that women were paying for the work, which was another whole level of involvement. And then later on, by the 1920s, because of the history of women in the observatory, when the graduate education program started, all the early astronomy graduate students were women, and Harvard awarded its first PhD in astronomy to a woman.
Now, did they all come out of the computer field?
Well, computer was a job description, so computers at observatories were really interested in star positions. That's mostly what they computed at the beginning. But then they got interested. Once Pickering came, and he was a physicist, so he was not content to map the sky. He wanted to know why the stars were different brightnesses, why their spectra were different. So it was the beginning of astrophysics. One of his first projects when he took over was this study of brightness, of trying to assess the brightness of all the stars.
I have to say, I get very excited about when we're talking about being close to science and numbers and all that kind of thing. And there's a particular job. And we always say, oh, the computers were women. It's like, well, what is this job? What exactly do you do? And what would you have to qualify? How would you qualify to do this job? Maybe this is a job I'd like to do. What did you do?
Well, unfortunately, you've already been replaced by a machine.
I was a computer science major as an undergraduate. I'm replacing myself every day.
Okay, yeah. Well, computer just meant someone who does the computation. And so there were always computers at observatories because when you ascertain the positions of the stars, you then have to make corrections on your observations. You have to correct for the distortion of the atmosphere, for the motion of the Earth in space. So there are many mathematical calculations that have to be done. So somebody was always around to do that. But once the photographs came in, then there was also discovery possible. And that's what set the women apart, that given these plates, they were able, as the director said, to see more on the photographic plate through a magnifying glass than a powerful telescope could reveal in the sky.
So you'd set the plate on, would it be a light box? The light was coming through it?
Well, they didn't have electricity yet. So the light box.
This is the 1880s. Yes.
Yeah. So electricity was around, but the observatory didn't have it. So you set the plate in a stand that is a picture frame tilted at an angle, and below it is a mirror that's angled at the window, so it catches the sunlight and throws that up through the plate, and then you're illuminated.
And then you take your eyepiece, which will magnify it.
Yes, and you look in, and you are looking for stars that change their brightness over time. You're looking at patterns in spectra. Depends what job has been given to you. But another surprise in all of this work is how much autonomy the women had. So Pickering wanted a classification system, but he didn't really tell them how to do that, what to look for, how to organize it. They were on their own, and they did it.
Now, I guess if you took 5 photographs in a row of anything, and you're like, okay, here's the picture, and here's the picture, and here's the picture. Every time you came back to it, it wasn't in the same place. So how did they align all these different plates?
That was what all the computation was about.
Ah.
So you can go back to exactly the
same
place.
You see the
place.
Same stars. They're yes. the same measurements away. And then you can overlay the numbers.
Yes. Yes. So you can track brightness over time, which was one of the very important things they did. Because the study of brightness over time is what led Henrietta Leavitt to her law that enabled the measurement of distance in space. So that was tremendously important and is another part of this history that is still in use. And her discovery, which was called the period luminosity relation, is now being changed to the Leavitt law.
Took a while. Good thing.
100
you
years.
Wait 100 yeah. years, give or take a few decades. What
yeah.
the heck?
Yeah.
It's sort of fascinating, you know, reading all this to see what are they capable of at the time. I mean, I just made the mistake in asking about this. It's like, oh, I guess there wasn't any electricity. You know, how do you do it? How do you get them done? There's a will. There's a way. And they're developing all of these techniques.
Yes.
How many computers were there at its peak at the Harvard Observatory?
About 20 at a time.
Yeah. That's a lot.
So they were about half the workforce.
And then we have astronomers, and they happen to be male at that time.
By 1896, when Annie Jump Cannon came, she had so much background experience, she was allowed to make telescope observations. And then more and more of the women coming out of the women's colleges, having a real background in the subject, they were allowed to do it. And then they went on to jobs at other observatories. So the situation at Harvard really changed attitudes about women's place in this science.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Dava Zobel. You certainly know her from her books, including Longitude and Galileo's Daughter. She's the recipient of the National Science Board's Individual Public Service Award. She's here today with The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. I guess it would make things easier if the telescope in South America was the same telescope that they had at Harvard. Is that what happened?
At first, the telescopes in the two hemispheres were pretty much the same. But the conditions in South America were so much better. The sky was so much darker that they really wanted a giant telescope. And Pickering put the word out, and another heiress came forward and wrote him a check for $50,000.
So he Which could, was a lot back
which
then.
Was a lot of money, more than $1 million in today's money. And her name was Catherine Wolfe Bruce. She also endowed a prize for the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, which is still given. It's a Lifetime Achievement Award. So her interest in astronomy was great, even though she came to it rather late in life, and she was very generous.
It occurs to me that in today's world of big data, everyone is looking at the data. There's something about this that the women that they hired as computers had the keys to understanding astronomy in their hands because they were working with the data.
The early women were called computers, but once they had these photographs, they were more astronomers. Or Pickering liked to talk about the plates in terms of books in a library, because each plate had such a wealth of information in it that no matter how carefully you examined it, you probably weren't extracting everything. And so he liked to talk about the women as being readers of this unique library. And in fact, the information content is still untapped, which is why the plates are currently being digitized.
See, more people will look at it
yeah.
in of both genders, and computers will look at it themselves,
yes.
real computers, what
yeah.
we would call a computer today.
Right. Right.
So that is, I mean, it's a fascinating concept because it's this data which actually moved forward, if you will, the conduit for moving forward the science of astronomy.
Yes. Yeah. The plates the plates were revelatory.
You had access to letters and diaries and memoirs. What did they tell you that the glass plates and the ledgers that they recorded all the data in, what did they tell you?
Well, this was a story with lots of characters. And I was worried at the beginning that the women would not be distinguishable one from another, that they would just sound like a lot of nerdy ladies, and that was a worry. And so I went to the correspondence and diaries to get their personalities. And fortunately, some of them really were very serious diarists, and the observatory correspondence was preserved religiously. Everything from buying a telescope to ordering water closet paper. There wasn't a single transaction that went undocumented.
How would you profile these ladies? Are they all very different, or are there some similarities?
They're different, and they came from very different backgrounds, and they had different skills. I'm happy to say they are quite different. One of the first ones to set herself apart was a Scottish immigrant who found herself suddenly single and pregnant and took a job in the residence at the observatory as a maid. But the director recognized her intelligence and moved her over to the observatory and then let her go home to Scotland to have her baby and promised her a job if she came back. And she came back and did the first published classification at Harvard. She classified 10,000 stars. And then she became the first woman at Harvard to have any kind of university title. Her name was Wilhelmina Fleming, and her title was Curator of Astronomical Photographs.
She's a particularly interesting person for me because this is a person who had no expectation of a great life. Everything, all the doors had shut. She was in a real fix from a cultural standpoint.
Yeah.
And yet the opportunity had been left open to her or given to her by Pickering. Again and again, he comes through in these funny little ways throughout the book that says he was recognizing these women. For instance,
definitely,
he listed them in all the research reports.
He always named them. He always gave credit to them individually by name, even ones who hadn't done that much. He would name all the ones who were involved in the proofreading or the double checking of the positions. Everybody's name got mentioned.
Bringing that data together, that's not easy, going from plate to plate or looking at the data. How did they do that? Do we have any sense?
Miss Leavitt, for example, when she was looking to discover variable stars, she would have a positive print made of a certain area of the sky, and then she would take the glass negatives over a period of time and compare them to the positive. And painstaking, there were tens of thousands of stars on each plate. So to be able to look at that and actually see pattern, see individual stars for what they were, track them over time, it's not something that anyone could do. Not something that just anyone could do.
I admire their eyesight, for starters.
Definitely. Eyesight, patience. And there's some sense that women have more patience for that kind of fine, detailed work.
Well, eventually everything grew up around Harvard. And every time we have more people there, we have more light. So that didn't fare well for the telescope.
Oh, no. The Harvard group had to move to a site about 30 miles away called Oak Ridge, and that was used for a number of years. That's also been abandoned now. It's shuttered. So the 300 astronomers, more or less, who work at Harvard now, many of them are theorists. Many of them are using telescopes elsewhere. The big 15-inch telescope that was the heart of the original Harvard College Observatory is used only at open nights to show Saturn.
It still works, actually
it needs some work, and that's something I've promised them, that that's something I would like to do as a give back to the observatory, is to get that telescope up to speed again.
And the 500,000 plates,
they're still there, they're in the process of being digitized. And last January there was a near catastrophic flood in the building, and about 60,000 of these plates got dipped in muddy water. So there was a major rescue effort, but it was successful. And the digitization equipment was drowned in the flood. But
we can replace that.
And it's all custom. Just as at the beginning, Pickering had to invent his photometers to do the work of measuring the brightness of the stars. All this digitization project, everything has had to be custom built to do, because there's no other resource like this. It's 100 years of the sky. The distance measurement changed the way people looked at it. The classification turned out to be a reflection of temperature, of stellar temperature. So that was a surprise. Each of these categories represented a temperature range. And then the first graduate student, Cecilia Payne, the first one who received a PhD, in the course of her doctoral research, she was looking at the chemical constitution and the relative proportions of elements in the stars, and realizing that hydrogen seemed to just dwarf everything else. It was a million times more prevalent than anything else. Nobody expected that. That was such a major shock that she was told to play that down and to say in her dissertation that that was probably a spurious result. But it took only 4 years. Once she had called attention to that discrepancy, the top people in the field looked into it, and sure enough, everyone came to agree that, yes, it really is almost entirely hydrogen and helium.
I've been speaking with Davis Sobel, the author of The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, strategies to get patients to take their prescribed medications, and one company's multiple approaches to avoid the downsides of opioids. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Davis Sobel, the author of The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. What are some of the big takeaways for you? I mean, it's a fascinating story. It's not just taking one person. We're interweaving a lot of people, a lot of experience, a lot of science.
Yes, there's a lot of science. How much changed? At the beginning of this story, nobody knew, had any concept of the extent of the universe. Even by the 1920s, the idea was that the Milky Way was the universe. And spiral forms seen at great distance were just little spiral things inside the Milky Way. But it took Hubble, Edwin Hubble, using Miss Leavitt's stars to say, no, those spiral things are really much farther away, and they are the equivalent of the Milky Way in their own right.
You know, I was just hearing today where Galileo's telescope was the first collection of big data in the world. You know, that we set it out there and all of this data came down that we didn't have before.
That's
that we
right.
couldn't store it.
Right.
That's a different issue.
Well, he made drawings.
But it was just furiously coming in that it couldn't happen before.
Right.
And it's shocking. You know, this is a real legacy of the path that's been coming further and further, bringing the whole universe into us as we look out.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's all this data. You can't deny what's on the plates. You can't deny what these women did. But, you know, in this day and time, you know, we're beginning to question when information comes to us, is it true or isn't it true? And what you're writing about has to be true.
Yeah, I'm afraid there's a terrible anti-science bias that really worries me. How can we be saying that climate change isn't happening? How can that be? So I feel it's more important than ever to tell true stories about science.
And real people in it.
And real people. And I was really happy to tell this story about women. I've not really told a women's story before. Galileo's daughter was not a woman in science. She was a woman close to a scientific revolution and a major player. But she herself was barred from that kind of work. She was very important in understanding the climate in which Galileo worked and his own mindset of actually being religious while he made these discoveries. But these women, I think many women don't even realize that they have internalized misogyny. And there's a sense of, well, if a woman did it, it couldn't be that important. And so I feel it's extremely important to tell these stories, especially for young women to know.
And us.
And us, too.
Us, too. Dava, always a pleasure. Please come back and see us again.
Happy to.
My guest today is Dava Sobel. The book is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. It's published by Viking. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, Health Prize Technologies creates strategies to get patients to take their prescribed medications, while Respire RX is working on multiple approaches to ameliorating the effects of opioids. In the medical field, it's called noncompliance. But for the rest of us, we simply say, hey, you're not taking your medications. I asked Tom Kotler, the CEO of Health Prize Technologies, is there a difference?
just terminology. And I think part of the problem with the problem is the terminology. So let's get the terminology straight so we can talk about it here. Non-adherence is the notion of patients not taking medication as prescribed by their healthcare professional, usually their doctor, but not always. And that might be that they do one of two things. They are non-compliant or they are non-persistent. And non-compliant is not taking your medication day to day in the right way, at the right time, in the right dose. And non-persistent means you don't stay on therapy. So it means you just stop filling your medication. So you can't take a medication you've chosen not to fulfill or refill.
And those people we would know for sure because they're not going back to get their prescriptions filled.
Well, it's really fascinating because it's not so much just going back, but so for example, part of the problem with talking about the non-adherence problem is it is not a single problem. It is a variety of different problems, and it can be broken down essentially initially into three separate problems. So the first problem is called primary non-adherence. That is patients who get a script written for a medication that never fill it.
Ever.
Ever. And shockingly, depending on the medication, this is anywhere from 15 to about 35% of patients never fill the first script. And a lot of people will say, well, I don't trust my doctor. I'm not a pill person. And as my co-founder, Dr. Katrina Furlick, once wrote in one of our a great blog posts, well, you're not a pill person. What are you, a disease person? But the number is shocking, and I'll give you a great example of it. There were some great studies done on patients discharged from the hospital post-MI. MI is a myocardial infarction or a heart attack. So these were patients who, as I say, have seen the white light at the end of the tunnel.
So they should be scared into it.
30% of them never filled their script for their CV medication after being discharged.
What's CV?
Cardiovascular medication. So
related directly to their heart.
Their heart medication, almost just north of 30% of them never filled their script for their heart medication after being discharged from the hospital after having a heart attack.
So what – I mean, what's the total impact on this? Do we have any idea? I don't know how to measure it.
It's really, really difficult to measure. But the gold standard for measurement is was done by NEHI, which is the New England Healthcare Institute, in a paper they published in August of 2009 called Thinking Outside the Pillbox, wherein they estimated that the medication non-adherence problem is responsible for $290 billion, with a B, of otherwise avoidable medical spending each year in the United States alone.
$290 billion.
Billion.
That if they had adhered to their drugs,
would not have been expended by the healthcare system.
That's expensive.
It is the single most expensive problem in all of healthcare. That's more than the cost of treating cancer or diabetes.
I guess another concern I have, or perhaps a greater concern I have, are for those things that, as you say, you get out of the hospital, you have a heart attack. You can die from this. You know, there are those that, well, you know, maybe this is an inconvenient chronic situation. But at other times, this can lead to premature demise.
The CDC used to measure this, but the measurement got attacked because it's really hard to do. But when they were doing it at one point, they estimated that it was the fourth greatest cause of death in the United States.
Give me some examples of what people do.
So what's really an incredible thing is that we see statistics on medication non-adherence constantly, and one after the other just is virtually impossible to believe. So let me give you some examples. One of the main reasons that patients reject their transplanted organs is they don't take their immunosuppressant drugs. And these are people given a second chance of life with someone else's organ inside their body, and they don't take their medication. Cancer patients don't take their medication. So, for example, women taking tamoxifen or Femara as adjuvant therapy post-chemo or radiation for their breast cancer are supposed to take a 5-year course of treatment typically. Around 60% are adherent after 1 year, and after 2 years, less than 40% are still taking their medication.
What's the psychology of this? Do people just not like to take things over time? What do we know about it?
So we know a couple of things. So let me take a step back. Historically, typically, we've looked at the medication non-adherence through two separate lenses, though we think both improper lenses. There's the lens of cost and the lens of forgetfulness. We'd like to believe that people are better than they are. So we say, oh, people forget. It's just not true. I mean, we do forget every once in a while to take a pill, but the missing of a dose once in a while is not the cause of poor outcomes that we're talking about. Really, what we like to say, you can't remind someone to take a medication that they've chosen not to purchase. About 90% of the problem of non-adherence has been estimated to be persistence. That is, patients just don't stay on therapy. The other thing is people say, well, it costs too much. And you constantly see in the newspaper or in the general media people saying, well, they don't take their medication because it costs too much. And in fact, for some people, though not the vast majority of people, this is in fact true. However, there are copay cards and patient assistance programs and all kinds of ways to help people pay for their medication should they truly wish to take their medication. And there have been study after study after study where medication and cost has been reduced to zero. Now, this does in fact move the bar, but not very far. Typically, I'll give you a great example. Patients were in a study called the MI Free Trial, and this is MI, again, MI, myocardial infarction. So patients who had a heart attack who were discharged from the hospital, and the experimental group had all their copays covered, so all their medications were free, not just their heart medication, but any other medication for a comorbid condition that they might have had. The control group, after being discharged, was sent on their merry way to do the regular thing they do with covering their copays. This covering of all the cost of the patient's medication increased adherence over a 12-month period from 39% to 44%, and that was it. And so reducing cost to zero, in fact, does increase adherence, just not by very much. And another great example is in the Netherlands, where there's lots of adherence research and no copays for any drugs of any kind. They have virtually the exact same rates of adherence as we do across indications in the United States.
Okay, what have you done?
So we've come to a couple of really, we think, important insights that we build into programs that we offer to patients through our sponsoring pharmaceutical brands. First is this. Behavioral economists call it present bias. That is, we're all wired to want things in the here and now, that short-term benefits often, almost always, trump long-term rewards. It's the same reason, for example, that very few of us save enough for retirement. It just seems so gosh darn far away that I'm going to buy that television today or go on a trip next year, and I'd rather than stick the money in the bank to save for when I'm retired and need the cash. And so it's that notion of wanting things in the here and now. It's a very human notion. It really comes from being a caveman, right? I need to worry about getting protein today. I'm not going to worry too much about saving up for a month from now, and I might not even be around. Present bias is stuck in our sort of DNA, as it were. And this is a thing behavioral economists have done studies on over and over and over again. So if you're talking about taking medication to stave off a recurrence of cancer 5 years from now or a heart attack 15 years from now, let's say, it's very hard to do that day to day to day to day, stay on your medication for many people. So this notion of present bias comes into play. We overcome that by offering people in our programs benefits in the here and now, immediacy, through gamification and use of a bunch of concepts from behavioral economics in our programs.
Put them into now.
Give them something right now.
Okay. How does this work? Like usually people say, and this is what our idea is. And I'm like, oh, I get it. This is what you do. It's like, I have no idea how you would get this to happen.
So we create unique digital experiences on top of our software as a service platform for our healthcare customers that they then offer to patients. And patients that enroll in these programs get weekly quizzes, weekly surveys, daily tips. We call the daily fortune cookie. We have.
Can I get frequent flyer mileage for taking my meds?
So we actually don't.
I was just going to help you there.
We actually don't.
I could do that. I'm really into my frequent flyer mileage.
So let me answer that question in two ways. One is we don't yet connect to frequent flyer programs. So we do give points for people for getting educated, for filling their script on time, for daily self-reporting, taking their medication, and doing other things related to their general well-being. So it is like a loyalty program for taking your meds. We don't yet connect directly to mileage programs, but we're working on it. I would say, secondly, what's really fascinating, I don't know how often.
Take your meds, take a trip. You'll be alive for starters.
There you go. Right? It gives you something to look forward to. So you got to take
really
your meds.
Good.
So what's really fascinating is if you look at people who could afford to take as many free flights as they wish to, but they will often actually, senior executives at companies, I don't know about you more, but people will actually take an airline flight that would be somewhat inconvenient versus the most convenient flight for the sole purpose of getting more points on their airline miles. They will inconvenience themselves. My co-founder, Katrina Furlick, who is a former neurosurgeon, tells a great story. She used to live in a town in Connecticut called New Canaan, which is a pretty upscale town. And there's a Baskin Robbins in town, and they give away twice a year free coupons for an ice cream. And the line is down the street on Main Street in New Canaan with, doctors and lawyers and hedge fund guys.
Gotta get my free ice cream.
They could buy the darn Baskin Robbins, the whole thing, probably the whole company, forget the whole franchise. And they're waiting in line to get a free scoop of ice cream. Or I'm here in San Francisco for bio. Lots of physicians and scientists here. If you had a booth that gave away free T-shirts, there'd be a line a mile long for a free $4 T-shirt. The power of free is this amazing thing. I mean, what people will do to get something for free.
And get a value. They get value.
Well, the funny part is they actually lose value, right? So that guy waiting in line with his daughter – now, he may – and most of those guys, by the way, don't like waiting in line for anything. But waiting in line with his daughter might get the value of actually spending some extra time with his daughter. But he's losing value. And you think about it. If you spend a half an hour in that line and you build $500 an hour at your job, you just paid $250 to get an ice cream cone.
Well, it all works in so many funny ways because everybody's motivated by different things.
Exactly.
It's like I remember saying to my then teenage son, you mean I just paid for you to fly all the way to Europe and you didn't sign up for the darn mileage program?
Yeah.
You're
right.
Making me crazy. You were halfway to a free trip,
And to that point, and that's a great point.
But that was me.
Well, here's the thing, right? So he didn't care about that.
No.
He cared about something else.
What does he care
so
about?
So one of the things that we have historically done in medication adherence intervention programs is we've always said, well, it's cost or forgiveness, so I'm going to remind you or I'm going to reduce your cost. And those are relatively simple one-trick ponies. And they do, in fact, move the bar. They don't move it very far. And for some people, they don't move it at all. But they're one-trick ponies. If you get tired of that one trick, there's really nothing left in that intervention to actually motivate you to do the right thing for yourself. So what we've done at Health Prize is we've taken a real kitchen sink approach. So to your point, so we have quizzes.
What else can you do for me?
We have quizzes and surveys and competitions and sweepstakes and leaderboards and all kinds of different little hooks to get people to get educated about the reason it's important for them to take their medication. And so you don't get tired of doing it. We've run programs in diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, psoriasis, acne, asthma, COPD. We're running programs in a bunch of specialty indications now. HIV. We're building a program in HIV right now. A program for hemophilia patients.
There's problems in adherence in HIV.
Huge problems.
Tell me, because we're down to one pill a day.
It's called an SDR, a single daily regimen, and patients don't take them. It's shocking because in the 1980s we had lots of AIDS patients fighting to their death for pills to be created and drug cocktails to be released that would,
20, 25,
that would extend
30
their
pills
lives.
A day, not uncommon.
Oh, had to be right on time. You had to live with a clock. Now it's take one pill once a day, and adherence rates are very, very bad. And there are studies in HIV which suggest that if you're less than 90% adherent, you're better off not taking the drug because you will, for yourself and for the HIV community, create resistance that is bad for the population as a whole.
Now, I heard you say something that sounded like the end game was education, that somehow
it is.
Why?
It is.
I already know it's going to be good for me.
You do, and then you don't. So let me give you a great example. We ran a program in high cholesterol, and we do a lot with trying to educate people because behavioral economists will tell you that one of the reasons we make really bad decisions is lack of data.
Don't know.
That's right. And so they call them heuristics or sort of shortcuts because we have to make so many decisions so frequently that we just don't have the data we need to make good decisions, so we make poor decisions. That's one of the reasons, and there are lots of others. In this case, so for example, we did a program with patients with high cholesterol, and most patients with high cholesterol do not know that high cholesterol is a risk factor for stroke, not just heart attack. And what we found out by taking quizzes and surveys with people in this program was that, in fact, very few of them knew this, And most of them were much more afraid of stroke than they were of a heart attack. And the reason is you don't see somebody who, or the effects of someone who's had a heart attack, whereas you see a stroke patient walking down the street with a cane or having lost control of their facial muscles and maybe having slurred speech, and you just don't want to be that person. And so once we
– that's a powerful motivator.
So once we found this out through quizzes and surveys and what we call our daily fortune cookie, which is a daily health tip, we hammered home the point to these patients in this program that risk – that high cholesterol was a significant risk factor, not just for heart attacks but for strokes. At the end of the study, over 90% of the people got the quiz questions right about stroke and high cholesterol, and – almost every patient in that program became more adherent to the medication as a result.
Tom Kotler is the CEO of HealthPrize Technologies. More information is available at healthprize.com. While we've been talking about people taking their medications, the current opioid epidemic points to problems with some of the medications themselves. There are now 200 million opioid prescriptions issued in the United States, and there's been 30,000 deaths. I asked Dr. Arnold Lippa, Chief Scientific Officer of RespireRx, if the opioid epidemic is a recent phenomenon or if it's been brewing for a while.
There's been a dramatic increase over the last 5 or 6 years, but it's always been an issue. It's just received public attention lately because we've seen so many celebrities. Not just Prince, but Michael Jackson, who died of a propofol overdose, but also causing respiratory depression. That's the major reason people die. You see, when you're taking opiates, for instance, say oxycodone, when you first start, you take a dose of 5 milligrams and it alleviates your pain. You have to go up to 50 milligrams before it starts suppressing your breathing. And if you keep going, you'll ultimately stop breathing. As you become tolerant to the drugs, which happens relatively quickly, you need more and more of the drug to reduce your pain. But tolerance doesn't develop so much to the respiratory depressant effects. So after several weeks, a month, you're now taking 20, 30, 40 milligrams of oxycodone, and you're right at the border there of starting to get respiratory depression. And it's very easy to fall over that threshold, and now you're in trouble.
Now, what does RespireRx do in this area?
We're developing a class of drugs called ampicons. Ampicons work by boosting the actions of a neurotransmitter in the brain called glutamate. Glutamate's the major excitatory transmitter in the brain. And the work is derived from a scientist at the University of Alberta who's worked with the company and really conducted a beautifully elegant piece of translational research. And it basically originates with the discovery that there are certain cells in the brain that act as pacemakers for breathing. If you knock out the cells, you knock out breathing. Those cells contain receptors for opiates, for barbiturates, and anesthetics. And when the drugs act on those receptors, the cells slow down their firing, and your breathing slows down. If you take too much, the cells stop firing, your breathing stops. Counteracting the effects of these depressant drugs, there are receptors for glutamate. The glutamate is excitatory, so it counteracts the effects of the drugs. And so now we've taken these ampicons, which boost glutamate, and find that they counteract the effects of these drugs, whether they're opiates or propofol, which is what killed Michael Jackson. They work at the level of the cell. They work in animals. And we have two studies that have been conducted showing they work in people. So that's what translational research is. You find a site of action, you develop drugs, and you bring it all the way up to human research.
Now, this is very interesting in the sense that it's not like opioids are all bad. We need a lot of these opioids.
You know, I give a lecture and I tell this story. Every good story needs a villain. And the villain in this case is the Greek god Morpheus, which is where the word morphine derives from. So Morpheus is the god of sleep and dreams, and he's usually depicted as one side white and one side black. So the white side, the good side, gives you pleasant dreams. He takes away your pain. The dark side of Morpheus can literally take away your breath. The opiates are still the most effective analgesics that we have, but they come with a whole host of problems. And we're trying to deal with some of those problems to make opiates safer.
Is the idea to give a second pill or a second injection?
Well, there are a number of ways of doing it, depending on the indication. We've identified a few. One indication is during surgery, because what are the drugs they use for anesthesia? They use fentanyl. Anybody who's had colonoscopy has gotten fentanyl. An anesthesiologist typically gives you a big slug of fentanyl. Your breathing slows down. They know it's working. Great measure.
Yeah.
We envision an intravenous formulation for that that can be given in conjunction with either propofol or fentanyl. We also envision it to be used in a post-surgical setting. What happens when you come out of anesthesia? They give you a little button and you get IV morphine. Well, there's a reason why that button stops working after a while, because they worry about respiratory depression. It's not always effective, but they can't give you any more. And now we have a way of making the drug safer. The third use that we're looking at is a proprietary formulation in conjunction with an opiate. So say we could take a long-acting oxycodone, combine it with one of our ampicons, and now when you start taking 20, 30, 40 milligrams, you're not going to get the respiratory depressant effects. And we can make it safer for the millions of people who are taking opiates. What's interesting is if you look at the opiate deaths, the 30,000, the public view is that, well, these, you know, they're junkies. They're heroin addicts. The fact is they're not. The majority of these people are people who are taking prescription meds given by a physician, and they just accidentally overdose because the drugs can be dangerous.
Dr. Arnold Lippa is the Chief Scientific Officer of RespireRx. More information is available at RespireRx.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.